Welcome, Chris, to Law & Disorder.
Thank you.
The title of your latest book, and it's a really good read, and I would encourage people to get Death of the Liberal Class, is intriguing. What were the institutions that liberals were involved in that are dying, and why?
Well, the pillars of the liberal establishment, liberal religious institutions, labor, public education, especially public universities, culture, the press, and finally the Democratic Party, which made incremental or piecemeal reform possible, which watched out for the interests and the grievances of those outside of the narrow power elite no longer function. The term neoliberalism or neoliberal is really a kind of reconfiguring of what it means to be a liberal in a democratic society. We have figures like Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Pelosi, and others who continue to speak in the traditional language of liberal values, and yet have betrayed every one of those values. The unfettering of the marketplace, the subservience to Wall Street, the slavish catering to the permanent war economy, the failure to defend basic civil liberties, including habeas corpus, or to prosecute war crimes such as torture. All of these have been embraced so that a liberal is ultimately, on the sort of core structural issues, indistinguishable from a conservative. And you can put Thomas Friedman's columns next to David Brooks's columns and see exactly what I mean. And the battles, to quote Freud, are really over the narcissism of minor difference.
One thing I thought was interesting when you talk about liberal and liberal class is the double role you saw it playing. One was to do, as you said, slight reforms, whatever term we want to use, but also was to legitimate the ruling power. And so it had this duality to it. And why don't you just talk about that for a minute, because it's something I hadn't thought about in the way you put it in your book.
Well, the liberal class or liberal institutions are traditionally allowed to function in a capitalist democracy because when there is a crisis within the society, they provide a formal channel or mechanism within the power structure by which injustices can be alleviated. The perfect example is the New Deal, which was not brought to us by great white liberals, but by sit-down strikes and bonus marchers and a resurgent Communist Party, and the liberal establishment embodied in figures like Henry Wallace, who was the vice president for Roosevelt, as well as Roosevelt himself, was able to create the New Deal and create regulations which inhibited the ability of corporate power to rape the country. That's a perfect example of how the liberal class functions, and Conrad Black, in his biography of Roosevelt, is right. What Roosevelt was not a traitor to his class, quite the opposite. Roosevelt saved capitalism. Now, with the rise of the corporate state, they fail to understand the importance of liberal institutions and the liberal class in giving credibility to and maintaining the power structure itself. They have corporatized all of the pillars of the liberal establishment, which I mentioned, the press, universities. Labor has been destroyed, and we are seeing the last readout of labor being decimated, public sector unions. I live in the state of New Jersey. This is the governor here, Chris Christie, has made war on the teachers' unions, although Cuomo is doing the same thing in New York. And there you go, a Democrat and a Republican embracing the same ideology. What kept the liberal class honest, I think, were these powerful populist progressive movements which held fast to moral imperatives, communists, socialists, anarchists. And I go all the way back in the book to World War I because that, as to quote Dwight MacDonald, was the rock on which these movements broke. The rise of the Committee for Public Information, known as the Creel Commission, was the first system of modern mass propaganda and was put in place by Wilson, who I think comes across as a very dark figure in American history.
I agree.
To propagandize the country to support the war, which had no popular support at all. It was a war that was pushed upon us because bankers had lent tremendous sums to the British and the French, and they knew that if the Germans won the war, they would not be paid back. And this was an important development in American history on many levels. It not only created the first system of modern mass propaganda, which crossed disciplinary lines, it had its own film division, Hollywood, which pretty much paid for itself, making movies like The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin kind of stuff, speakers, bureaus, it produced its own news division that pumped out pro-war news stories. And when you go back and read those who held out against this war fervor, people like Jane Addams or Randolph Bourne, they're stunned at not only how effective it is, but how many people who define themselves as socialists or progressives, or even radicals, are seduced by it. So that you then have the passage of the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, but it is actually not used very much. It's used against those few holdouts, like The Masses, which was a socialist publication, is shut down. Eugene Debs, of course, eventually the leader of the Socialist Party, ends up in prison, but it's used selectively. But what happens, and again, MacDonald writes about this, I think, quite presciently, is that everything shifts within American society, because you enter a culture of kind of permanent war psychosis. The dreaded Hun is instantly replaced with the dreaded Red. And these progressive populist forces are broken and liberal institutions disemboweled by the witch hunts that takes place within them, the ACLU. And of course, we saw the breakdown of capitalism in the 30s, a slight resurgence of these movements, and then the horrible Red Scare after World War II, which decimated what was left these movements. And so you had thousands of university professors, social workers, high school teachers, government officials, journalists, who became, including like I.F. Stone, becomes a pariah. He can't even get a job at The Nation magazine and ends up printing I.F. Stone's weekly in his basement. A lot of these people, of course, had nothing to do with the Communist Party. And so the destruction of these populist radical movements, coupled with the kind of internal purging carried out primarily by careerists, people like Sidney Hook and others, but really took away from us the mechanisms by which we could fight back. And with the gradual kind of coup d'etat in slow motion that the corporations have carried out in the United States, beginning with Reagan, accelerated by Clinton, Bush, and certainly furthered by Obama, we're left powerless. We have no mechanism to fight back. And just one other point, going back to that Creel Commission, not only were they very astute in terms of all the mediums they employed to disseminate propaganda, but these people had studied very closely mass psychology, as it had been investigated by Lebon, Trotter, and finally Freud.
And Freud's nephew.
And Edward Bernays was, yes, Freud's nephew twice over. And so they understood that people were not moved primarily by fact or reason, but could be manipulated through emotion, what Walter Lippmann's 1922 book Public Opinion calls manufacturing dissent. And well, these people went straight from the Creel Commission to Madison Avenue to work both for government and for corporations. And this is the result. We live in a society utterly saturated with lies.
We're talking with Chris Hedges. The book is Death of the Liberal Class. Chris, can you talk a bit about how, with the influence of corporations, the liberal class does not want to lose its well-paid status, and you know, professors earning up to $200,000 a year, labor leaders, and also how universities no longer teach critical thinking?
I mean, the liberal class has been reduced to the status of courtiers. They have economically, at least up until now, not suffered the same deprivation that has been visited on the working class, and increasingly the corporate state is rapidly reconfiguring American society into a form of neo-feudalism, where you have these speculators on Wall Street earning $900,000 an hour, and families of four barely able to feed and sustain themselves and forget the ability to pay medical bills. The elite institutions of education, which charge astronomical sums, my son is at one of them, $52,000 a year, essentially provide education for the elite while we gut public education. But the larger point, both within the elite institutions, and I've taught at some of them, Princeton, Columbia, NYU, is that everything is vocational. In the for-profit universities, which are the largest sort of growing sector within the education establishment. You don't even teach the liberal arts. You don't teach critical thinking. People are trained to work as cogs within the corporate structure. Inner city schools are turned into boot camps. That's what charter schools are about, and along with, of course, the ability to break teachers' unions. And everybody has their place. It solidifies a kind of caste system. And there's no hope of escape, or almost no hope of escape, although we're, of course, fed endless stories about the few exceptions to somehow make us think that we're responsible for our own predicament. This has been one of the most vicious things that's been visited on the working class in this country.
Chris, one of the really important points I think you make in the book that I hadn't thought about at all was when you talk about the death of the liberal class and these institutions, and of course, co-optation or cooperation with the corporate class is another way to look at the death. But you talk about then what happens in this vacuum, that there's no longer these liberal institutions that have reforms and the whole country is they're absent. And then you talk about really what happens, who fills that vacuum. And just talk about that a little bit, because that is some explanation for what's going on in the country right now.
Well, the liberal class traditionally is tolerated by the power elite, or was, because it castigated radicals. I mean, the figure that I think liberals hate most, and I can tell you this with some authority, having spent 15 years at the New York Times, is not Glenn Beck, it's Noam Chomsky. Because he calls out their collaboration with the power elite, the limits that they impose and that they won't cross. When the liberal class doesn't work anymore, when it's discarded by a power elite, and I think very foolishly by the power elite, you in essence turn that safety valve off. That possibility for limited reform no longer works, which of course is the problem. It's how we get absurdities like something called a job bill that ends up being $15 billion in tax credits for corporations. It's how we can stand by passively as 3 million people are forced from their homes through foreclosures and bank repossessions last year and another 3 million this year and do nothing. The danger is that as these grievances mount, there is no mechanism within traditional structures of power or traditional institutions by which these injustices can be ameliorated. And so they become expressed, and they are being expressed, in these kind of very frightening proto-fascist movements, such as the Tea Party, militias, or through demagogues such as Glenn Beck or Sarah Palin and others, who give legitimacy to this anger and rage and sense of betrayal. And I would argue that the rage, the sense of betrayal, is legitimate, is real. These people have a right to be angry, and they have a right to feel that they have been betrayed. They have been. Unfortunately, part of their anger is directed not only at government, and of course very cleverly deflected away from Wall Street, but at liberals. And I think not wrongly. I think liberals, the hypocrisy of the liberal class, the hypocrisy of figures like Clinton or Obama, is readily apparent to those on the lower end of the economic spectrum, who hear these people speak one way and yet act another. In some ways, that increases the rage towards liberals. Now, the political agenda that is always put forward by these movements is irrational, as the Tea Party agenda is. The idea that, you know, we want government out of our lives, but don't touch unemployment benefits, Social Security, Medicaid, or Medicare. The idea that, you know, we want to not touch the military, as if the military is not part of government. And of course, it consumes half of all discretionary spending. It doesn't actually make any sense, but it provides an acceptable emotional outlet. And unfortunately, those who manipulate these emotions, while a liberal class loses touch completely and continues to speak in the kind of dead language of policies and issues, those who manipulate this seek scapegoats. It's the old story. I watched it in the breakdown of Yugoslavia. Suddenly, the Kosovar Albanians or the Muslims or the Croats become the reason for your economic distress. And remember, the war in Yugoslavia was caused by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia, not by ancient ethnic hatreds. And we're seeing the same thing here, so that you have undocumented workers, Muslims, liberals, homosexuals. All of these people become convenient targets, lightning rods for the rage and violence that is sort of bubbling up from the bottom of American society. And that is the danger of the collapse of a liberal class, because when these liberal institutions, when these mechanisms for reform are shut tight, or when they ossify and die, then the anger is expressed and manifests itself in very frightening forms.
Chris Hedges, author of Death of the Liberal Class, that was really powerfully said. I thought that your time at the New York Times and your relating that story to our listeners would be very worthwhile. Can you tell us what happened there? You were really one of the jewels in that newspaper, and all of a sudden you're not writing for them anymore. How do you fit your own personal story into this whole narrative about the death of the liberal class?
Well, there are very clear lines. They're not written or published, but if you reach any kind of position of responsibility within these institutions, you learn what those lines are, and you don't cross them. I interview Sidney Shanberg in the book because he's a good example of somebody who did cross them. He began writing about what developers were doing in New York, and that did not please his editors or the publisher, and he was eventually pushed aside to the Village Voice. In my own case, it was a matter of, and I had spent 7 years in the Middle East. I speak Arabic, a lot of time in Iraq. Had published a book called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, which put me sort of on the circuit. And I would end up on shows like Charlie Rose and others, and I would be asked about the impending build up for an invasion into Iraq, which I denounced, as I think all Arabists did, even those in the State Department and the intelligence community and the Pentagon. We knew that it was a fantasy-driven enterprise, the idea that we were going to be greeted as liberators or that democracy would be implanted in Baghdad and emanate out across the Middle East or that the oil revenues were paid for the reconstruction was not a reality-based belief system. And yet to say that, and I think sometimes we forget how popular that war was tantamount to professional suicide. I'd been there long enough to know that I was doing, and I continued to speak out and was eventually booed off of a commencement stage in Rockford College in Rockford, Illinois, where the crowd got up and started singing God Bless America and cut my microphone twice. And the trash talk shows got a hold of the home movie footage and looped it. You know, they just ran it over and over and over, and they lynch you in the same way they lynched my friend Jeremiah Wright, or they turn, I think, very those few lonely figures like Ralph Nader or Kucinich who get up and speak into figures of ridicule. And the paper was forced to respond because of the public outcry by the right wing. And the way they responded was to issue me a formal written reprimand for impugning the impartiality of the New York Times. In essence, we're gilled. So they give you written warning, and then the next time you violate that warning, you can be fired. And of course, I knew that I had a choice. I could muzzle myself in service to my own career, but to do so would be to betray, I think, everything, every value system that I held, and so I left the paper. I think that those, you can find people within these institutions who are driven by a very real concern for those outside the power elite and seek to give expression to their suffering and pain and those injustices, but those people don't often last within those institutions.
Chris, that allows me to segue into something that we're all eager to hear you talk on, and that's what's going on in Egypt today and by extension the rest of the countries that have been affected by the huge rebellion in Egypt. And with respect to the impartiality of the New York Times, we've all been reading the Times, among other news sources. What's your take on how the Times is covering the United States' reaction to what's going on in Egypt and what's really going on in Egypt?
And you actually were reporting from Egypt for a number of years for the Times, is that right?
Yes. Well, the problem with, and I wouldn't say this is just the problem with the Times coverage, I think it's almost across the board, is that every time there are popular demonstrations against a dictator, we paint the opposition as if they're us. I saw that in the opposition to the street demonstrations against Milosevic. The Serbs leading the street demonstrations, including the students, were nationalists. They brought the Archbishop of the Serbian Archbishop to march with them, but not the Imam or the Catholic Cardinal. And I think that this is part of the problem in the way we cover the uprising or the rebellion in Egypt, is that we paint the opposition as if they're us, and they're not us. Egyptians have their own history, their own sets of concerns. Over half of the Egyptian population, a country of 80 million, are desperately poor, struggling on less than $2 a day. There is tremendous popularity for Islamic movements, especially the Muslim Brotherhood, but even other more radical movements. The collective humiliation that Egyptians and most Muslims feel over the presence of American troops on Muslim soil, and not just in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in the staging areas like Doha or Kuwait or Saudi Arabia, is deeply angering. The capitulation to Israel, the failure to stand up for the Palestinians, and remember the Mubarak regime is openly collaborates with Israel because it closes off the southern border of Gaza, essentially participating actively in the siege that is imposed upon Gaza. All of these things color the vision of the opposition. And I think that with the breakup of the Mubarak regime, as well as many of these bankrupt secular regimes, which have sold out to Western interests and refused to stand up for basic concerns within the Muslim and the Arab world, we are inevitably going to see a shift towards a government that has a much more pronounced Islamic coloring, even if Mohamed al-Baradei, who has no real base within Egypt, ends up being a transitional figure. I think part of the reason the Muslim Brotherhood is so happily to embrace it is because they know in the end that they will walk away if there is a democratic opening with a significant amount of power. And I really think this is the result of the inability on the part of the United States to deal with any kind of vision or justice towards the Arab world. And they, along with their ally Israel, have traditionally believed that they can speak to the Muslim street exclusively in the language of a force and power. And that is, I think, backfired on them. And you know, what we're going to see if there is not a radical shift in the way we and Israel relate to the Arab world is a rise of Islamic states that will essentially sort of act as a kind of noose around Israel. And I go back all the way to Oslo and King Hussein. I mean, there were so many chances that we and Israel blew. So we're not going to get a Jeffersonian democracy out of this. We're going to get something, and I have no problem with the Muslim Brotherhood. I find them just as I found the Algerian Islamists generally out of the professional class. I mean, they're not a threat, but I think we respond to anything with that kind of coloring as a threat, and therefore only seek to, because of our response, the result is that we radicalize it further and further and further, as we've seen with the Palestinians.
I mean, I think that's interesting about the Muslim Brotherhood, because I consider myself at least a relatively wide reader and knowledgeable, and yet I really didn't have a sense of who they were. And if you talk to people on the street, they look at them as if they're al-Qaeda. And, of course, if you go to the Muslim Brotherhood website, they're against al-Qaeda. And
yeah, well, and no, a lot of people don't know that al-Qaeda not only hates the Brotherhood, but they've declared Hamas as apostates because they negotiated with the Israelis through intermediaries in Cairo. Everything it's like communism, you know, as if Yugoslav communism is the same as East German communism. It's not. And having spent 7 years in the Middle East, you see these variations. And also you understand that these groups, especially the Brotherhood, is a very established party. Now, it is not going to be a slave to American or Israeli interests. But if you crush the Brotherhood, you will get radical configurations that I think are much more frightening. This is kind of self-fulfilling prophecy to American and Israeli policy in the Middle East.
Chris, let's come home for a bit, because I wanted to give you a chance to speak about your notions about what people, like the people that listen to Law and Disorder, what people like us should be doing now in the wake of this death of the liberal class. What are you, when you go out and speak, what do you advocate in terms of people say, what should we be doing?
I think it's imperative upon all of us who care about protecting civil society that we begin to engage in acts of civil disobedience, because we are the last thin line of defense between a complete collapse of society. And remember, the undercurrent of violence in American culture runs very deep. It's not a joke when these Tea Party people bring their guns and celebrate the gun culture at their events. It's not funny. The fact is that the we live in a system that no longer cares to concern itself with the needs or rights of citizens. And the only weapon we have left is our physical acts of, in my case, nonviolent defiance.
And I think recently you actually were arrested. Is that right, Chris?
Yes.
And where was that?
In Washington with mostly veterans, 131 veterans, Daniel Ellsberg among them, denouncing the war and a rally against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think that it's extremely important that we stop living within the illusion that we're going to reform the Democratic Party or that any of these institutions are going to come to our aid. All of them have been hollowed out. All of them have been destroyed. None of them are going to take a stand at a moment, I think, that a very precarious moment in American history. We who, I think, see it, have a kind of responsibility as citizens to, as much as we can, jam sticks into the cogs of the machine.
The old saboteur word, right? When they put shoes in the machinery, right, Chris?
That's a good way to go.
But Chris, we really appreciate it. Every sentence you say is just really, I think for all of us sitting here, is just so meaningful and important. And the book is a really fine book. It just explains much more than I think any of us were able to explain without this book. We're speaking with Chris Hedges, Death of the Liberal Class. And again, Chris, thank you for all you've done and all you're going to do.
Thanks, Michael.
Bye, Chris. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey.
He was great.
Yeah, thanks very much for doing it.